Security is mostly a superstition. It does not exist in nature, nor do the children of men as a whole experience it. Avoiding danger is no safer in the long run than outright exposure. Life is either a daring adventure or nothing. Helen Keller.
Welcome to the Lost Traveler podcast. I am your ever-loving host, Henry Cameron Allen. And today I have a guest who I am meeting for the first time, as are many of you. Her name is Beata Chalette, and she is an entrepreneur. She's probably the poster Wonder Woman of entrepreneurial world.
This is me laughing, yes.
You know, I mean, seriously, everything that I've read about you, everything that I... you know, have looked up and done my homework and my bag. I'm not even going to give the list because that'll take up precious real estate in our conversation. But I will list all of your links and your books and everything that you are in the description box below. But welcome. I'm so happy to meet you.
I'm so happy to meet you too. I thought that this idea that we're going to have a conversation of a little bit of philosophy, life lessons, stuff, you know, in some of the teachings and the forums, we call it staying in the 5% of the stuff that really matters. Super excited.
Thank you. And I started the Lost Traveler podcast 4 years ago, and it was one of those things that sprung out of COVID that was unexpected. We're all sitting around twiddling our thumbs thinking, well, what do I do now? And I thought, you know, I love talking to people. I consider myself to be a global citizen. I have an American passport, but that's about where it ends. And I thought, why not reach out to people around the world who have reached a certain proficiency in their own universal life skills journey? I call it a journey because it's not a destination. There is no ultimate proficiency in everything. There is no human being walking the planet who is an expert in everything. And these are universal skills that every single human being on the planet, regardless of where they come from, their skin color, their socioeconomic status, all of this, we're all learning the same skills from birth. It's not a question of whether we learn them. And when I say life skills, I'm talking about emotional literacy, communication skills, financial literacy and trade, grief, nutrition, health and well-being, environmental literacy, right? We all learn these in some measure. Who are we learning them from? And how well are we learning them? And as you so aptly said before we started recording, how long does it take us to apply what we've learned? Where did you, in hindsight, where was your source? Like, where was your mentorship and your, what was the turning point for you in that self-awareness of, oh, I'm deficient here, I need to ramp up my skills?
I think that the turning point, probably not surprisingly, like for many people, is anger. When you are perpetually stuck in this cranky, upset, angry state that you feel you're working, you're not getting it together, life is passing you by, relationships fail, relationships are difficult, relationship with your mother is impossible, your brother's a jerk, your romantic relationships don't work. Work is just work and work and work and more work, and it never ends. There's no time for yourself. And you just keep hitting these bumps after bumps after bumps. And then you look at people and it just looks easier somewhere else. And then you wonder, what is it? So for me, it was really a turning point of when I had literally lost everything and I was $135,000 in debt. And I had to borrow money to pay interest on borrowed money. My dad died. I'm at the funeral. I get a call. My office calls me. We're losing the house. And I'm standing there. My best friend has died. I have a small child. I don't even know what the heck am I going to do now. And it came to the point where I literally had to surrender to the fight and the battle. And I raised my fist against God and I yelled and I said, if you have a plan, you know, I mean, dude, seriously, this would be a really good time to fill me in because I just can't understand what the heck is happening here.
Yeah.
And when the pressure is this intense and there is so much at stake, Henry, what do? You literally, there was no more fight left. I had fought for everything and I had nothing left to fight. And I surrendered. And that's when things started to turn. And then 18 months later, I sold my business for multi-millions to Bill Gates and came back with a miraculous rise. So I think that the piece that I had to understand is that opportunity doesn't show up wrapped up in the Tiffany box with a bow on it, but that opportunity shows up as a pile of just, ugh. And that it is presented to you in a way that you say, you want me to do what? And if you do it anyway, without the judgment of saying, I set the vision, I set the goal, I set this is where it was going to go. And if you keep judging every step along the way, you will never get there because we don't have the knowledge of the steps that we need to take to get there.
Right.
That's a higher power. That's God, that's spirit, that's the universe, that's whatever you want to call it. And as long as you fight that, you cannot get there. It's that ease and understanding. And so that was what I had to learn. How do I get out of this anger? And then 10 years later, I'm finding myself back really angry because then I'm doing this business and it's not doing what I wanted to do. And it's just, you know, and I thought I had it all, you know, I mean, I self-made millionaire. I sold my business to Bill Gates. I mean, how hard can it be? Why am I back in this? And I'm back really angry. And I'm like, let me think about what I had to do. I had to let go of the anger. I had to surrender. I had to trust. I had to get clear on my vision. And then I just had to keep taking the steps that were coming and not judge that the stuff that was falling apart fell apart to hurt me or punish me, but it fell apart because it was never mine in the first place.
Oh, that's such a powerful lesson. And that's a universal lesson. I think everybody who is listening has resonance with what you're talking about. You know, and I am convinced in my journey, which has been a lot of up and down, a lot of anger, a lot of rage and sadness and despair. I remember my grandmother consoling me one time and she said, honey, when you hit bottom, there's only one way to go up. Right. And I think I fell into life skills because I did not see it around me in my own journey. I didn't see it in my education. I didn't see it in my home. I saw my parents struggling, fighting, angry, and lacking the skills to teach the most basic human life skills to their children. And to this day, when I interview young people, especially teens, for instance, I ask them, where do you learn your life skills? 98.99% do not say from my parents. They also do not say from my school. They say from TikTok. They say from their peers and by watching the world around them. And I
such a crazy point if you really think about it. Pardon me for interrupting.
Oh yeah.
But I think that there is a really important piece that we need to understand here that when I talk about this, Henry, I talk about it, the entire educational system and the business code that we all follow is built on very simple parameters. Mm-hmm. Take existing information, learn existing information, remember existing information, regurgitate existing information, get an A.
Mm-hmm.
And that works for a very particular type of person. What, 5% of the population? Those are the people that end up in government that are at the post office. And God bless them. Thank you. Thank you for doing that. And thank you for being, you know, the rule followers. But that's not innovation. That's not advancement.
Right.
That's not how AI was created. That's not how anything was created. That is the recipe for status quo. So how is it possible that we are creating a whole system that is designed to keep status quo and reward people for wanting to stay in the status quo when the measurement of success is anything but status quo? So there is such a paradox and friction built into how we're raising children that how can they be anything but anxious, depressed, and frustrated? Because it's like, but I see the world, and then you talk. But there's the world, but you tell me this. But here's what, and this is what you want. And so this discrepancy is almost like impossible to overcome. But what if that was designed to activate the resistance? Maybe the gift is within the resistance.
Hey, are you like me, always looking for ways to make a positive impact in the world? Well, then join me in sponsoring Desire Child Care Organization. We are a legally incorporated, fully volunteer-based organization in Uganda, committed to providing essential needs, holistic arts-based education, and a safe family environment to 33 vulnerable children, ages 2 to 14. Your monthly sponsorship can help improve the lives of these kids toward a better future. Desire Childcare is different from any other charity I know because, well, we have zero administrative overhead. Every penny goes to the kids. And we have a plan toward self-sufficiency through agriculture. So support is temporary. It's kind of like a leg up. Visit desirechildcare.org to learn more and get involved. Let's empower and inspire the Desire Kids together. Thanks.
Well, and it is by design. I mean, you look at the forms of mainstream education globally that really got their start in the Industrial Revolution, where they were taking children out of nature, off of farms, sitting them down for hours at a time in a room, putting them in desks, teaching them how to be factory workers. Now it may not be factory workers as much because of robotics and all that. It's now teaching them to sit in a cubicle on a floor of a, 300 story building with hundreds of other cubicles next to people who you know nothing about, nor do you trust. And you're in the hamster wheel still, and it's 100+ years on. And I think that there are philosophies when you get out of the bubble and you travel the world and you start to look at, for instance, the yogic culture, where children are not really formally educated until about age 12. And by educated, I mean data. And by educated, I don't mean the original meaning of education, because when you go back to the Latin root of the word educato, it means to draw out of, as if from a well, to lead out of, not to thrust data into the head of a child. That's in, meaning in, trudo, meaning thrust, right? So it is intrusion. And so we have the means, we have the knowledge, we have the history to get beyond that and allow children their childhood without compressing them into this concentrated cube that will fit into a prefabricated box. When I was in high school, I wanted to make a t-shirt for myself that said too big for the box.
Yeah, I heard somebody say something really great about a box too. And she had said, it's not always about being outside the box. So sometimes when you're in the box, it's also about what else can you do in the box? You know, what are the tools that are available to you that you can formulate, which is the Apollo 13 principle. You know, how do you get them back from what would have been a doomed mission? There was nobody was going to drop off a couple of bags of supplies. That was it. That's what you had. And that is what created these crazy solutions. So I like this idea, Henry, of what you said, that it's thrusting in and pulling out. Now, if we were to believe that the universal knowledge or the access to this spiritual, higher spiritual energy that holds all the answers, that connects everything, you know, a Panchamama, Mother Earth, the universal energy that we all really draw from. And if we were to connect back to that, what would that actually look like? And that is one of the reasons I signed up for an ayahuasca journey. And ooh. And I'm going on my first ayahuasca journey in about 2 months or so. And I did that because I felt that there is a certain disconnect in this German immigrant in the United States, strategist, but I've always had an incredible connection to energy. Mm-hmm. So when I was little, I went flying at night. So I remember, you know, getting out of my body and flying around. And then when I told people about it, they say, yeah, you need to just like stop that, because they, you know, didn't know what to do. That World War II child, my mother, World War II survivor, my grandmother, just stop it, Beate, just stop it, you know, stop it with this nonsense. And when I met my partner and we had, you know, connected for the first time, and I said, what are you doing? He says, I'm sending you energy. And I'm like, oh, okay. And so for me to be able to receive that and feel that, I'm like, what? It just felt different. And then when he went on his journey and he connected with me, I literally, you know, every night I knew exactly when he was thinking about me. I knew exactly what he was doing energetically. I told him, I said, last night at 11 o'clock, you crawled into bed with me as an energy. I said, and you helped me and you spooned me and you told me how much you loved me. He said, that's exactly what I did.
Yeah.
So if that connection exists, right? And we are so disconnected from that energy, then what are we capable of if we reestablish that connection? And I think that is what a lot of the friction that we're experiencing, especially with this younger generation, which I find absolutely fascinating. Fascinating, because they don't have a bucket full of shit that's gone wrong. They've been handed the bucket of shit that we did wrong. And now we're standing here.
Isn't that generational, right? Though? I mean, isn't that generational? Didn't we inherit the same bucket? And didn't our parents inherit the same bucket? And
I think so. Yes. Yes. Yeah, I think so too, because our parents were bloody hippies, right? Yeah. I mean, not mine, but.
No, mine either. My mom wanted to be, and she should have been, but no, that's not what happened.
They should have been all hippies. And then look at what happened to those hippies. They became boomers, the most bloody boring conservative.
What the heck? I mean, seriously, I'm a child of the 60s. I'm 57 years old. I was born right smack in the middle of the 60s.
And, yeah, right there with you.
And I watched it unfold. And I watched my parents, my father being very conservative in his attitudes about everything from spirituality to women. And I saw my mother, who was a butterfly with her wings clipped, an amazing force of creativity and love, unable to break out of the box that was built, that she was thrust into, right? When we talk about boxes, there are the boxes we build for ourselves that are custom fit, and there are the boxes that we are told we must chop off an arm or a wing or a leg to fit into. And that's a pivotal part of the conversation. But yeah, I mean, you look at the boomers, you look at the ones who were hippies or the ones who could have been or perhaps should have been. But, you know, I still, what I've come to now is that everything that has passed happened because it was meant to. As hard as that is, when we're looking at, for instance, World War II, and we're looking at all the way back, I mean, we're looking at, you know, Genghis Khan, you know, and beyond. There are so many things, there's so many sufferings, there's so many challenges that we as human beings have faced throughout our history, and, you know, enslavement and so forth, genocide. How can that have been for a purpose? And what I've come to, what brings me a bit of peace, is an understanding about frequency and about energy, as you were saying, and the contradiction of what we know through the science of physics to be true so far, and what we've been taught is true. And what I know to be true, because I am a little bit of a science nerd, I love delving into quantum mechanics and all of that. I'm actually working on a project right now called Quantum Grief. And I've identified 12 dimensions of grieving, and nobody's talking about it. I'm like, well, why isn't anybody talking about this? But the point of it is that there is only one frequency. Everything else is illusion. The one frequency is love. The Beatles got it right. All you need is love, because that's all there is. There is no imbalance that we've been told. Everything is in perfect balance. Otherwise, it would be otherwise. If you and I were meant to be in a different moment, having a different conversation with somebody else, we would be. There is a reason that your entire biography and your parents' biography and your grandparents' biography and mine, all the way back to our common ancestor, mitochondrial Eve, back in East Africa, all of that pain, all of that suffering, all of that fear, all of that joy, all of that love has led us and prepared us for this moment specifically. Because everything that preceded this moment only exists in our memory, which is imagination. Everything beyond this moment only exists in our imagination. Right? So all bets are off. The answer is that everything is possible, because we are already the frequency. We are already the one energy. We are not individual guests at a party. We are the party. When are we going to wake up to that? I think we can. I think it's that simple.
I like that. I think that the challenge that we often have with that is that, so the mother is abusive. Why? How is that that I have to go through that? Father's absent. Why is that that I have to go through that? Mm-hmm. My friend, no problem. Super job right at college. Couldn't do it. Why is that? I think the judgment of the experience is the problem. Because the judgment, the meaning that we give what happens is what hinders us to enjoy the experience. And the deeper I look into this, it's interesting that you say you're totally into science, because the more we look into this, we know that mindset and spiritual principle and science are the same bloody laws.
Same thing. Yep.
Same thing. So, you know, the law of polarity, magnetism. I mean, it's mind blowing. So we have this idea, and wherever that was born, that somebody has an unfair advantage. And then when I look at the playbook of how dictatorships happen, it is the playbook of making people feel that somebody has an unfair advantage, and then stoking that original fear of abandonment and the original fear of not being good enough and the original fear of that somebody did something behind your back that you didn't know. With that door open to distrust, you can plant any message. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing it right now all over the world.
That's right. We've never not seen it.
Mm-hmm.
Think of a time. Has there ever been a time in our living history or in human written history where the world has not been in that kind of chaos and that kind of control and division and kings and popes and leaders dividing people, keeping them fearful? A fearful people is a controllable people.
Greetings, greetings, greetings. I'm Queen Bee Divine. The cure is conversation. And where can you find me? At BluntReflections.com, where I will be talking to guests from around the world that not only share their time, but their insights and their tips on how they became the best version of who they were meant to be. So if you're looking for a great story and a great time, check me out at BluntReflections.com. The cure is conversation. And remember, blasé, blasé means to tell your story.
I have a question for you. Mm-hmm. Do you have a fear today?
Yeah, I have many fears. I have a fear that I've wasted my time, that I, you know, should have had, that I should have just retired, that I shouldn't have made this investment in this particular business that is designed to help all these people. And it's not loving me back as much as I love it, you know, and I've had so many bumps in this business where I'm going like, you know, so before COVID, I'm a keynote speaker and I'm talking about women leadership and everything is hunky-dory. I'm in Silicon Valley, equity, equal pay. I mean, you know, we talk in Merck Pharmaceuticals, we talk in Chevron. And COVID comes and the whole women leadership conversation is wiped out again. And look what happened to it in the days since. So I'm like, did I do this for nothing? So then I've had to refocus on, you know, when you get death threats, because you talk about that women should earn the same amount of money than men do, because people in COVID have nothing other to do than sit at home and stew that they have to sit at home by themselves, and especially the incels. Involuntary celibacy, and Google served me in front of them. Yeah, that was rough, you know, to the point where we had to have a conversation and my partner said, you need to stop, because I don't want people with a gun in front of our house shooting you, because you have doxing threats and death threats. Mm-hmm. Big wake up call. So you go, dear God, what is this about? So, and then you pivot again. So yes, I have a fear that all this love and energy and money that I put into all of this to build these systems and shortcuts, really, I mean, my specialty really is to build shortcuts to achieve outcomes in leadership and in business. That's what I do. And then sometimes you feel like nobody wants it. But you know, people want it, but they don't want to do the work. And then you keep going at it. And so, yes, my fear is, should I not have gone on a beach, ordered Mai Tais with umbrellas in it? Would that not have been a better alternative to this constant friction that I felt for the, again, last 10 years? So, yes, I have plenty of fears. My inability to surrender. That's a fear, because if I surrender control, German immigrant, you know, come a lot of hardship.
Yeah.
Surrender to what? That God is good, that I trust the universe? That's so easily said.
Yeah.
Until you keep putting out your own money that you had to earn hard the first time and go like, well, how much of this can I possibly invest in this until I see a return? And what is the return? And then I remind myself that at the end of the day, you know, like Mark Manson said in The Art of Not Giving a Fuck, that hypothetically speaking, we knew what the outcome was, death. If we knew that that was the outcome, which apparently most of us don't, if we knew this was the outcome, what would you do to reverse engineer your path so that when you get to that point that you have a great exit?
Well, that's strategy, isn't it?
That is strategy. Well, that's what I do. So.
It's like a backwards map. You know, yeah. I mean, that's what you have to be able to, this is where I come from in the imagination, the power of the imagination, because everything in the future is living only in your imagination.
Exactly.
In the past, right? Even if you shared an experience with a partner, with a parent, with a child, you're going to have a different memory than they do. So it's your imagination that is recreating that memory and that history. The power of the imagination of the human consciousness is amazing. And the reason I'm such a science nerd around quantum theory and quantum mechanics is I'm fascinated by the unpredictability of it all. I sit in a childlike sense of wonder and acceptance at the unpredictability of it all. When I was in graduate school at the National Theater Conservatory, I'm a theater guy. The woman, the teacher, Kathy Brindle, who I adored, day one, first day of class, she said, open your books. She was our speech and voice teacher. And I learned so much from her. And the first thing she said, I want you to write in big black letters at the top of your journal, fuck it. And we all like giggled because here's this woman in her 60s, first of all, saying fuck it. But second of all, we didn't know what she meant. We were all a little uncomfortable in that moment, as you know, humor often is. And she said, now, I'm saying fuck it, not as in you're giving up anything, but you're giving in, you're surrendering. And I had this memory in that moment of going on a whitewater rafting trip with my mom when I was a tween. And I remember the guide saying, now, if you fall out of the boat, which may happens all the time in the white water, it's really, really rough. And if you're flailing about trying to latch onto a branch or a rock, you're going to get really banged up, broken bones, or maybe even worse. What you do is you lie back in the water.
Put your feet up.
Put your feet up and you trust that you can float and the water will carry you around all those obstacles with no effort from you and it'll bring you to calmer waters. And that has been a metaphor for me for the past 30 some years in my life. I put my feet up, I lean back, take a deep breath, which totally affects your vagal system, your vagus system. And it allows you to come find your balance again. That simple act of recognition. And it all came from saying, fuck it, I'm surrendering to the process that I cannot control because it's unpredictable. I can have a plan, I can have a vision that I can reverse engineer to, right, this moment, but I can't control it. And to be able to surrender to the process, recognizing that this moment that you're in is so precious. Nobody's promised it tomorrow. Not one of us. We could plan till the cows come home. Nobody's promised it tomorrow. And I know this because actually today happens to be the 15-year milestone of my son's passing from brain cancer at age 13.
Sorry to hear that.
Me too. I miss him.
Yeah, I can't imagine.
I also don't believe I can't either. I mean, it's been what a ride, but it's been a fascinating journey. And again, the understanding about death itself, you know, we talk about death being the end point. Well, guess what? It's not.
The transition point. Yeah.
It's a transition.
Well, interesting. Today is my daughter's birthday. My daughter's 31st birthday, and she just had a baby. So I am now a grandparent of a 6 week old little baby girl. What you said struck a note. There's two things that I want to add to that. So number one, I think the surrender piece, the trust, it's easy to surrender if you go on a train and you know the train will take you in 2 hours from Tokyo to Kyoto.
I'll tell you why I'm laughing at that, but go ahead.
Right. Which I'll be taking in 2 weeks. So it's actually 2 hours and 40 minutes. So that's easy to surrender to that because you made the decision, you made the plan. There's a precedence for that. But then we say, I surrender that I've set up for this to be successful, for me to find my partner, for me to be happy, for me to find a job, for me to do whatever it is. And then we say, but I don't trust it. Because what if something goes wrong? So I think surrender in itself is a very interesting conversation, certainly a very, very difficult one for me, because, you know, and that's again part of why I'm going on this ayahuasca journey. One of the big things I want to release is this need to control and my inability to surrender, which I know where it comes from: abusive childhood, crazy, mentally challenged mother, a lack of safe environment. And my story is hardly unique. It's not exactly like I can say my story was the worst story. There's many, many stories that are 100 times worse than my story, but it is my story.
Yes.
And so there's a part of the surrender and the living in the presence. That, to me, has been a theme that's coming up a lot, specifically this week. As I made the commitment to do this journey, what I'm finding is that already I feel this connection with the shaman's been established. And we talk in, you know, 2-3 months out. But I'm already having dreams, really, really vivid dreams of, you know, I'm in this house and it's a house where I go into a part of the house that I don't ever go into. Mm-hmm. And I'm finally going in the rooms I haven't gone into. And I see all the shit that's on the walls, you know, like weird fuzzy things with pink glitter. And I'm like, well, I need to just rip it off. And as I do, I'm going like, this isn't even my stuff. That's a leftover from what other people left. Then I pull out, I literally pull it all down. And then there's just a nice clean white wall behind it. And then I'm going like, I wonder what's under the carpet. And then I wake up and I'm like waking up with this.
Yeah.
And so my partner says, well, you're obviously already preparing for your journey because you are now already opening some of these pieces that you know exist that you don't really want to go to. And, you know, last night I had another one of these dreams. So the challenge I think right now most of us are having is how do we make this moment the moment? The idea, so last night I was laying in bed. And, you know, and I could tell my brain's like going, and I want to shut it off. And then I'm going like, let me go into gratitude.
Yeah.
What do I have right now at 11 o'clock in my bed at night to be grateful for? I'm going, this is the softest pillow. And the sheets are freshly washed and they smell so good. And it feels amazing to have my skin touched this freshly washed pillow sheet on this brand new pillow that I bought, whatever, 2 months ago. And then I fell asleep.
And I think that nails it. You nailed it. I mean, that's the answer to your question. How do we live in the moment? We find that center of gratitude. That's how I start every day. I don't allow myself to open my eyes, even if I'm fully lucid and awake. I don't open my eyes until I have gone down the list of everything. Sometimes it takes me 20 minutes to open my eyes, sometimes 2 hours. To express the gratitude, to notice and list the things that I have achieved, the things that I have in my surroundings. I'm in a beautiful 800-year-old house in a tiny remote village in Spain. I mean, it's just a magical place. And I also pay attention to my dreams. There is no scientist on the planet today that can tell you whether your dream state or your waking state are what is real. And so to think of your dream state as being as real as your waking state, with all the lessons, with all the messages, I have very productive dreams. And part of my grief journey these past 15 years, especially around milestone days like this, you know, birthdays and holidays, you know, those moments throughout the year, I go into what I can only describe as sleep paralysis, which is a thing. It's an actual documented phenomenon where you are in a deep state of sleep, in a dream state, and you are lucid in your dream state, you're fully aware of your surroundings, what's going on, all the sparkly things on the wall, right? What's under the rug, all those real moments. And you know you want to open your eyes and get on with your day. You can sense that the sun is up. You can hear outside, you know, people stirring. You cannot open your eyes. You cannot move a muscle. You can't even wiggle your toe. The first time it happened, I thought I had died or I was in a coma. I had no idea. It was frightening. It was really, really scary. And I'm not a fearful person. I have no fear, zero. But I was afraid because I didn't know what was going on. And then finally, I broke out of it. And after it had happened three or four more times, I started to realize that what that was my body's way of protecting me from real world triggers. And I was able to find gratitude in the sleep paralysis because great wisdom came to me and I had full control in my dream state. If there was a dark something coming at me, I could pull a magic wand out of the sky, turn it into a cupcake and eat it, right? That's the power of dreams. But I'm convinced you can do that in certain ways in the waking life as well. Everything is possible. And so to come back to gratitude, that moment of gratitude, to recognize where you are, what you have, not comparing yourself to anyone else, because we can't. Why can't we? Because we're all the same thing. We're all part of one mechanism. That's what I see as God. God is one thing. And that one thing is that love frequency and energy. The physical stuff doesn't matter. We're made of all the same stuff as the dust particles all the way out in space. You know, stars and planets and comets and meteors and all that. We're made of all the same chemicals and all the same materials. None of that matters. Death is not a real thing. And so when people say, oh, I'm sorry for your loss, I'm like, well, it's not a loss. I know precisely where Cameron is. He's not like a set of keys or a favorite scarf that I can't find. I know exactly where he is. I didn't lose him. The difference, the only difference, is that he now lives in here, in my heart, in my body, rather than outside my body. We're still a great team. We still have a dynamic relationship. His hand is in every aspect of my life. And I'm very connected to that, but not just Cameron, all of my ancestors. Cameron is my ancestor now. He's my blood relation who preceded me in that transition. So he is my ancestor. My child is my ancestor. Mind blow, right? Talk about a complete paradigm shift and the way that one meets the world. And I'm finding that a lot of what we call peregrines now, because to date there's been no word like widow or orphan for a parent who's outlived a child.
Sponsorship and listener support of the Lost Traveler podcast benefits the Lost Travelers Club, a volunteer-operated charitable foundation under United Charitable, a 501c3 public charity. Peregrine is the proper noun we now use to describe a parent who endures the loss of their beloved child, forever carrying their memory and embarking on a lifelong journey of grief, resilience, and hope. The Lost Travelers Club provides programs, resources, and empowerment opportunities for peregrines globally who are navigating their grief journey. Parents of child loss, getting there together. You can support this important work by becoming a sponsor of this podcast or visiting www.losttravelers.club for more information or to make a donation. Thanks for listening and for your continued support.
That's so true. You're absolutely right. There is,
any language, but now we have one. And I hope you'll use it. It's peregrine. And that came in a dream as well. A peregrine falcon flew down, stopped in front of me, looked up and said, it's time. I knew exactly what it meant. That's our word. And I woke up, it was about 3 a.m. and I started researching the root of peregrine. What does it mean? Wow. in its earliest form of Latin, it meant a traveler in a field, or a stranger in a field, or a lost traveler, right? It also means a pilgrim, someone on a sacred journey. It ticked all the boxes, and it's a universal symbol internationally. It's native to every continent except Antarctica, right? So people will recognize it as a symbol. And in most cultures, it represents strength, courage, resilience, all of these things that we are as parents who have outlived our kids, right? There's no healing from this.
No.
There's enduring. There's survival.
Yeah.
It's coping.
Yeah. What I like this idea that there is a design, a creation of an experience that this presents, rather than a bad marker in the road. The transformation just happened at an unexpected time, because it is not written in the books that the child goes before the parent.
When is that? When in human history has that not been the case? Children have been preceding their parents since the beginning of people. This is nothing new.
Yeah, especially in wars and things like that, because it's always the young.
Farming accidents, you know, or
childbirth.
Wild beasts.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, you'd think of all of the ways that children, you know, starvation and famine, all of that stuff. I mean,
yeah, we have a lot of that right now. Yeah.
We have a lot, still have a lot of it. It's nothing new. And so, what I'm here to talk about and make visible is that there are other perspectives on death, the death of a loved one, be it a parent, be it a friend. People will say to me, oh, child death is the worst thing that can happen to a person. And I'm grateful that they acknowledge my pain. And I also always think, well, how is it worse than somebody's best friend getting gunned down in cold blood, or suicide, or beloved parent, you know, dying from cancer, or Alzheimer's, whatever. I mean, there are so many things on the list of ways people can go that I cannot say are better or worse than my situation. The problem is in comparison of it. I think we all lack
the meaning
in grief.
Well, yeah, the meaning, you know, the meaning we give it.
Yeah.
I probably would be prone to say something similar, because the assumed role of the parent is the protection of the child.
Wait.
And then to reap the rewards of this protection and the gift that the child brings to you throughout your life, you know, like with my daughter, walking her down the aisle and having been in the room when the baby was born, and having this unbelievable gift of, you know, the crowning of the head, you know, and I was the one that was standing there and watching it. And then the Jedi move of the doctor with a corkscrew pulled the getting the baby out.
Yeah.
I mean, these are moments. Would I have not had that, I probably would have felt cheated in some way, because that is, albeit an expectation, but that is certainly an expectation that I had, and I hoped I would get. I mean, I would have survived if it wasn't the case, but
right. But
to not even have that as an option on the table anymore, I think that's the hard part. And that, I think that that is the recognition about this particular understanding of the magnitude of this loss, is that suddenly all these moments are no longer in this lifetime available. And that is maybe the empathetic outpour to say it is like nothing else, because it's irrevocably gone.
I totally understand it, because it's the greatest fear of every parent.
It is the greatest fear of every parent.
In fact,
with my dad was 70. You know, he had pancreatic cancer, died in 6 weeks, but he had a fucking great life.
Yeah, yeah. My dad too. Yeah. Just passed from COVID a couple of years ago. And it was a different experience. But I think it was also different for me, as every death is now, because of my experience with Cameron. Mm-hmm. I was not a fearful child. I was not afraid of the dark. I was not afraid of monsters under my bed or in my closet. I was really not afraid of anything. And yet, when I attended the American school, the American, or the, it wasn't the American school there, it was the international school in Vienna. My second grade teacher, Mrs. Fend, which I love that name to this day, because it's like fend for yourself. But she had us write a paragraph on our greatest fear. And I was sitting at home, 8 years old, looking at a
blank your brain, paper,
thinking, why would any adult ask a child to focus on their fear? What's that about? And I couldn't think of anything. And I thought of it, and I thought of it. And the only thing that I could conceive that I could say I was fearful of was outliving my children. That's what the paragraph was. My dad saved it. He saved everything, but I found it in a packet of envelopes, you know, 40 years later. And I got chills because called.
Did you remember that?
I didn't until I read it. And then it was like a flashback. And I
That's
remember
wild.
The smell of the wood on my desk and the pencil shavings and all of
those
that.
Those old desks with all the, you know, markers of other people, yes. You know, that we had in Europe where people
yes.
like.
Yeah, gouged their.
Gouged their, yeah, gouged their names, you know? In it. Yes. And they said, it wasn't me. My name is John. It says John. It wasn't me.
Uh-huh. Rest of my life. That was my overarching fear. If I had to name a fear, that was it. And now I'm on the other side of that. So if there is a gift to be found in the experience, is that I, at only 57, I get to walk this world, this time, fearlessly for all to see. And I'm just a guy. So if anybody is a witness, they effortlessly, automatically have permission to walk fearlessly as well. How does fear serve you? If it's not serving you, move through it, because it's there for a reason, for you to meet it and to move, break through the membrane, you know, into a new way of thinking. And
that is that, you know, this to me is so timely right now. And this is back to what we talked about, that there's no accident, coincidence, okay, that we're talking today, my daughter's birthday, your son's anniversary of his transition. And we talk about fears and all these things. I believe that if we would share something with whoever is here right now or experiencing something, or the wish that I had specifically would be to trust that this is a friendly universe, to trust that there is no evil God. And when you were talking, I remember when I, you know, I'm raised Catholic, and when we had to go to confession, and I remember I'm sitting there and I'm wrecking my brain. Okay, I got to come up with something because I'm in mandatory confession. You know, it's yeah. Easter. It's you know, and then I went to Catholic school and I couldn't think of anything because really, I really didn't lie. And yeah, I mean, I took like a couple bucks out of my mother's wallet. And when my dad found out, he realized it may be time for us to get allowance so we could buy ourselves a lollipop. And that's what that turned into. But other than that, I really never did that. And I didn't, you know, I didn't cheat. I mean, that just wasn't who I was. And I remember sitting down, wrecking my brain, trying to make the priest happy so that he can give me like two Hail Marys. And then, I mean, what a brilliant, brilliant way to do that. It's like, go to church, you just tell them, you know, all the crap you do. And then they give you two Hail Marys and two Our Fathers. And that's it. You're done.
People pleaser training.
I mean, how is that? So the stepping into what is fear here for, that's actually a really interesting a path to take. So if, you know, in the spiritual teachings, it's always about the gift is in the darkness. The gift is the place you don't want to go. The revelation, the solution lies into where you're resisting. The, you know, if you don't want to look into your finances because you know they're shitty, then that's where the answer lies. If you, you know, I had a really interesting thing happen in my relationship. So we had a very rocky bump. And it comes from that, you know, we go to a high performance coach to really work on these rituals and how do we cherish each other for a prolonged period of time, which is a little bit of work if you want to really know the truth.
A lot of work.
And so I got very angry and disillusioned because we talk about it and then it's always up to me to come up with the, hey, what are we going to do? And then all I hear is like, I'm busy. I have people owe me so much money. I have to do the billing. I have to work on the weekend. So my love language, quality time, just went out the window. And then I got so tired of fighting that instead of what my high performance coach recommended me to do, she says, go into your feminine divine. That's a work in progress. And stop the fighting and talk about your feelings and your emotions and your vulnerabilities. Tall order for me. Not comfortable. Very, very unsafe for me. But what I realized is that I cannot take this on to make this something that I need to fix. So I said, I'm going to make myself happy. So I started going out and spending quality time with my daughter and with a baby, going to dinner with my friends, until it took a couple of months. And then finally he confronted me and he says, you always want quality time with me, but you're never here. And him coming to the conclusion on his own on what that felt like, not in the realization that that's what he did, but now in the realization it was done to him and him not liking it, the complete opposite of how I had designed this. Because I wanted him to go like, oh, I'm such a jerk. That's what I have been doing to her. She's playing it back to me. Right. I totally get it. That's such a shitty move. I'm going to be better. I'm going to tell her how much I love her. Quality time. No, that's not how he got that. How he got that. He says, you are not keeping your word because you said you want quality time and now you're not here. So, huh? What are you going to do with that? And I'm like, it worked. Just
like Wonder Woman, where are your cuffs and, you know, all the deflections.
Are you tired of feeling run down? Do you wish there was a natural, non-invasive, drug-free way to improve your overall health and well-being? If so, then let me introduce you to the Super Patch Company. Super Patches are a range of small neurotech patches that can help with a variety of issues, including sleep, immunity, pain mitigation, athletic performance, focus, anxiety, and stress. They're safe for everyone to use, and they're backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. So what are you waiting for? Order your Super Patches today. Now available in the EU, UK, Turkey, Canada, and the US. If you're ready to take control of your health, you can find out more online at dianedinkmeyer.superpatch.com. Super Patches. There's a patch for that.
You know, when I'm working with a client, one of the things that I offer up in similar situations where there's a lot of accusatory conversation and communication, you did this, or you made me feel this, or you never there, or whatever. I ask them to write what I call a love letter, and you don't have to give it to the other person. And this could be your partner, romantic partner. It could be your kid. It could be your boss. It could be your colleague, whatever. It could be the butcher down the street. But to sit down and write a letter that says, dear so-and-so, I feel hurt because this. I feel angry because this. I feel sad because this. I feel frustrated because this. You doesn't ever come into the picture. I feel. It's owning your own feelings. And the last line of the letter is, and I love you because. And very often, they'll want to give it to their partner. They'll want to give it to this person that they're having conflict with, because it comes back down to that frequency. It comes all the other stuff is baloney. It has no bearing on anything. It only has the power that you're willing to give it, just like the darkness, just like this shadow self that everyone's so fearful of and stressed out about. What is a shadow? It's merely a symptom of our being in the physical, in the face of light. That's all shadow is. The light, we can see it, we can feel it, radiant heat on our face, and it makes our skin glow, and it gives us health, it gives us our very life, that light. We're part of it. It's a symbiotic relationship. It gives and it receives our gratitude, right? But the shadow, what's that thing behind me, that dark thing that I see in my periphery? Is it part of me? It's attached to me, so I must own it. It's moving the way I move. It's shaped like me, right? And we turn around sometimes, human beings, and we get caught up in that shadow, in that darkness, and we don't know how to turn back around. We forget the light that we're part of, that pure light, love, energy that we are. Right? Rumi said that your cracks are where the light gets in. I say bullshit. Your cracks are where your light, the light that you are, gets out into the world. Your pain is your power, baby.
Well, there's something to be said about that. I think this particular thing, I mean, number one, it just literally happened like a couple of days ago. Mm-hmm. And it was so unexpected that that my expectation was this, and then his breakthrough was finally confronting me on something that bothered him, which really was a reflection of his own behavior that it took him this long to figure out, right? To recognize. And when he did, I just said, I think it's great that you're talking about this. Tell me more. Because at this point, I'm really stepping out of judgment. I'm just in appreciation of the experience, because I'm like, this is so fascinating, mm-hmm. on how this is unfolding in its own universe of, we had the same experience, and my interpretation is this, and his interpretation is that.
Right.
But it's the same experience on how the same occurrence can be viewed so incredibly differently. And to your point, the darkness, part of this darkness in my own personal experience, or one of the reasons why I'm going and stepping into this ayahuasca journey, is because there's a disconnect that happens often in childhood because of an unmet need, of a misunderstanding or not knowing of what a parent goes through. Because if we go back and we would watch our parents now, completely overwhelmed, three kids, probably postpartum depression, my father cheating on my mother, her trying to, you know, with no education, having been forced out of school at 12 to now be the wife of a CEO of a dairy company who travels all over the world, trying to just like keep it together. Her only way to do it is like dressing herself up so she looks the part, right? And then desperately trying to gain knowledge so she could have conversations on a particular type of level, which she really kind of couldn't, because she didn't understand these types of things, but she understood other kinds of things. Now, if I would now go back to that and I'd, pardon me, watch this poor woman in a way, or this woman that self-empowered herself to run with this to the best of her abilities with what was available to her to transmorph herself into a position where she at least felt she could play the part, I probably would have a different opinion about her, other than this crazy abuser drove me to a suicide attempt.
Right. Right.
Because what she tried to prevent me from was what her own fear was, not having enough education.
Protecting, yeah, yeah.
So the darkness are the leftover breadcrumbs of the things on how you experienced it at the time, because we were helpless. And up until 7, that stuff's just being put in our brains and our souls and our DNA without even having any resistance to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they just multiply. And then one day we wake up and we go like, but why am I not happy? Why can I not love? Why can I not surrender? Why can I not trust? Why can I not do something? And you realize this is great image. I'm sure you've seen this 1,000 times of the guy that, like, you know, carries that backpack. And I was doing a 90-day training with David Nagel, my mindset trainer. And there was this image that I had that I was trying to sail on a boat, but there was an anchor and the anchor was stuck. And I went and I dove into the water and I looked at the anchor and it was really badly stuck. Then I took diving lessons, got better gear, you know, studied reefs and, you know, and rocks and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, just really got into looking at that anchor, looking at that rock, looking how it was stuck, becoming an expert on stuck anchors. And then one day somebody hands me a knife and says, you want to sail? Cut the anchor. Whoa. To me, I hadn't even thought about it.
Right. That's right. And that's the deficiency in your life skill that everybody has their own deficiencies in. And you're the only one who can realize that I'm not getting the result that I want. Nobody can tell you that you're not getting the result that you conceive of, that you've imagined, right? But just like any other skill, if you want to learn a violin, or if you want to learn how to play a sport, or if you want to go and learn Chinese cuisine, you go find an expert in those skills to help you elevate your skill level proficiency, right? You're the only one who knows that you want to elevate your skills.
Mm-hmm.
And then you take action to find somebody who's got those skills in their toolkit, not in a way that you can use them the way they did, because you're not them. But what you can do is open your own toolkit next to it and say, I think I can synthesize this tool with this tool that I already have or have made and make it a stronger, more effective tool, right? We build on one another's toolkits in that sense, but we're the only ones individually who can identify where our deficiencies are. Sometimes someone will hand you a tool that you've not played with before, like a knife to cut the rope, right? And that actually, it's an epiphany moment of, oh, I wish I had known before it was so easy. But then you sit in gratitude for the skills you did learn in that process that now will remove the boulder out of your path for the next time you meet something similar.
In my nice collection of knives that I can hand out, not to everybody who I see dragging around.
Right. You can be being stuck with the knife.
Yeah. I'm like, need a knife?
I got plenty. I'm
all collection by now. Yeah. But that's so interesting that it takes us a particular amount of time to get to a particular kind of conclusion. And then we listen to something. And then I listen to it again 3 months later. Where was I 3 months ago? Because I know, I know as a matter of fact, I listened to it, but I did not hear that.
Couldn't.
But now I'm hearing this.
That's right. Because, and that's why this is the Lost Traveler podcast. Because I'll tell you real quick the story of how the Lost Traveler image came, because it's tied to why I giggled about your train story, about, you know, you can predict that you're going to get in 2 hours from here to there, right? Well, I was in the UK, looking to establish my theater company. And because I am a non-European citizen, this is before Brexit, so UK was still Europe, I could only stay on a tourist visa for 3 months. Then I had to leave the country, but then I could come back for another 3 months for a total of 6 months as a tourist, right? So I decided, okay, where do I want to go? I've been here, I've been there, I've been all over Europe. But I've never been to Belgium. So I'm going to go to Belgium. I'm going to go to the Belgian coast and I'm going to eat Belgian waffles and drink Belgian beer and chocolate, you know. And so I took the train from London to Brussels and I had to switch trains to Blankenberg, which is on the coast, this little resort town. And they gave me the wrong ticket and I ended up in Germany. Oh, to your point, you don't always know you're going to get to where you want to go to. Someone's going to hand you a knife or they're going to hand you a wrong ticket, right? But that took me to a different destination. I got off the train and I said, "Where's Blankenberg?" And they said, "Oh, that's Veover on the other side of the country. It's on the coast. And what are you doing here?" And I was like, "Well, here's my ticket. This is the one they gave me." "Oh, they gave you the wrong ticket." I said, "Well, is there a train from here to there?" "No, you have to go back to Brussels, change trains again, and then you'll get to Blankenberg." So I got back to Brussels, and there was a woman sitting behind the glass, the ticketing agent, smoking. And she looked at my ticket. She looked at me after I explained what happened and took a big drag off her cigarette. And her best Marlene Dietrich impression, she said, "Ah, you are a lost traveler." And I said, "What? You are a lost traveler." And I
You're
said,
a lost traveler, yeah.
I almost cried because that was the first time, Beate, that I had ever heard outside of myself somebody express what it feels like to have outlived a kid. You feel like a lost traveler. You have no compass. Your compass is broken. And you rely on somebody to pivot you in this direction or that direction or get a ticket here or there. They're going to give you the wrong ticket and then you end up in Germany, right? And I was holding that thought for a while. And a couple of days later, I took a train to Bruges. And there was a group of women, turns out later, found out they were Dutch. But they were having a great time. They're about five or six women, ages late 20s to late 50s or early 60s. And they were screaming with laughter, having a wonderful time, very jolly. And we got off the train and they all circled around me because they wanted to fawn over my service dog, Flat Stanley. And they said, "Oh, what is an assistance dog?" Because, you know, it's what it says on his harness. And I explained to them what he does for me. And I said, "Tell me your story." I said, "You're obviously having a great time. Are you family or friends on holiday? What is it?" No. We have a nonprofit organization called Colegas." I said, "Oh, colega, like colleagues, like you're in the same line of work." No. We're all young widows. And we formed this group. It's a travel club for us to step back out of our isolation of our grief into the world powerfully with others who understand the journey that we're on because they've been walking it as well.
Oh my God, I have such
Oh,
emotion with this.
chills, chills.
Yeah, no, you're right. Yeah.
I'm walking around Bruges and I'm hardly enjoying myself because I'm thinking about colegas and I'm thinking, what a beautiful gesture for peregrines, for parents who have outlived their kids to step out powerfully into the world on travel excursions with people who get it, right? To travel is everything. So I got back to my hotel and I called my fiscal sponsor and I said, because I already had established an organization, a foundation. And I said, "What would it take for me to change the mission and the name and the branding?" They said, "Just tell us, we'll do it. It won't cost you a thing. All the funds that are in the account will transfer over to the new name. That's it." So within 48 hours, the Lost Travelers Club was born, right? So this is the club that nobody wants to belong to, but we're here and we might as well form a club and step out of our isolation together. And so this podcast, the Lost Travelers Club, through sponsorship and donations, feeds the Lost Travelers Club. And the point of the podcast, the point of the club is that we are all lost travelers, but there's an irony in that, especially after COVID. Nobody knows what's going to happen tomorrow. Could be another virus right around the corner. We don't know. But the irony of it is that, like you were saying earlier, it's an illusion. There is no destination here. We are all going to arrive somewhere. And it may be expected, it may be planned, it may be unexpected and unplanned. That's the adventure. That's the unpredictability again, right? And so we are all of us lost travelers. We're all pioneers. Everything is possible. It's just a question of perspective and how we identify time and space, not in a continuum or a timeline that we've been taught. It's a pinpoint in time and space, this moment, this very moment. And this moment is surrounded by what I see as a peacock tail of infinite possibilities. All you have to choose is one. And if you arrive at a point B after making your choice, and that point B doesn't feel good, it doesn't feel right, it doesn't feel safe or happy, then it's probably not.
But wrong ticket.
Magically, it turns into a brand new point A surrounded by infinite possibilities. And all you have to do is choose a direction. It's, for me, that simple.
A guy wire is a tensioned cable that is designed to enhance the stability of a freestanding structure. Think of me as your guy wire. In terms of life skills mentoring, you're perfectly capable of standing stably on your own two feet. But I'm a cable that can enhance your stability. I'm available for individual or couples counseling, life skills mentorship, child loss grief support, LGBTQ+ support. I can also officiate weddings, end-of-life ceremonies, baby namings, invocations, or whatever guidance you may need. I serve all genders, all ages. Sessions are affordable, discreet, private, and conducted online. Find me at guy-wire.org. Book your appointment today.
Well, the redirect, if it is done by choice, is infinitely easier than the redirect that is forced up on you. Because there is the judgment of the redirect. So if I am facing the loss of a husband, a child, a parent, that is a forced upon redirect. If it is me quitting my job, I'm making the choice. If I'm being laid off, it is forced upon me. So I think the judgment of the redirect, like, we want to be in control over all the redirects in our lives. However, and this came to me as you were speaking, the redirects that are forced up on you are much more powerful than your own decisions. Because it is, if I were to trust, when I stood in the dry lake bed as a producer here in Los Angeles, my first music video, that was the dream. I wanted to be like an MTV video producer. Mm. I'm doing my first video. And, it's like early in the morning, the sun is rising, the trucks show up, the grip truck, the talent, the stylist, the hair and makeup, the motorhome, the director. I mean, and I'm standing there and I'm hearing this voice, you need to go bigger. And I'm like, oh, shut up. I'm finally here. I'm finally doing what I wanted to do. And now I'm hearing the voice. And I did not heed the voice. I lost my production business in September 11th in one day, in 24 hours. I lost $500,000 overnight. Never able to rebuild it. 6 months prior to that, I lost my stock, my photography representation business because of a bad employee. They got too close to a key vendor and they set up their business without me. Oh. And that forced me to build up the stock photography syndication under unbelievable circumstances and with no money. And that's the thing that I sold. These were all things that were forced up on me. And, in between my dad dies and this fires, floods, riots, earthquakes, September, 11th, the tsunami. I mean, you name it. It's all in this. But if I now look back and I say, if I could put the spiritual journey in there, it is a spiritual journey by the book. Because it was the hardship that forced the decisions.
Yeah.
The decisions that led me to set the goal, equity business, had to be making money while I wasn't there. I learned my lesson from the lawsuit. Setting up a business model that wasn't relying on one person, learned my business from the lawsuit. Making sure that it was untouchable by natural catastrophes, learned my lesson on September 11th. Had to be in a business that would work globally, learned my lesson from the dry lake bed, go global. And suddenly everything I've ever done fell into place. And then when the ship came in, it was a luxury liner, not a dinghy. So I set my mindset to the goal. I became that person. I had no plan B. I followed that path. I did what I needed to do to get there. And then I hit the dark part. I pushed through it, and then everything changed in 18 months.
Yeah.
So the journey, you know, where they say the journey is the gift, the journey is kind of the gift, but when you're in the shit show part of the journey, and you drag in this bucket of shit that can go wrong with you, it's smelly and disgusting and heavy, and you're sweaty, and it's humidity and mosquitoes. There's nothing here to say, what a great journey. If I'm on the luxury liner and I'm having my champagne, you know, with my whatever Marlene Dietrich moment, and I say, what a great ride.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then it's easy. But that is the part, I think, of the human experience of us learning to not judge these moments as despair. And so today when stuff happens, I just go, didn't work.
Now what?
So now we can exclude that.
Yeah.
Now, what's the next thing? So it's no longer the attachment to the failure and the perception of, oh, I'll never get there.
Yeah. And was it a failure if you learned from it? That's a universal question. And
well, we think if it cost money, it was a failure. That's how everybody judges it. Yes.
Yeah, that's how everyone judges it. But, you know, listen, I tell you, I live very, very simply. And that is not my focus. And security, as Helen Keller said, is mostly a myth. It does not exist in nature, nor do the children of men as a whole experience it. Avoiding risk is no less dangerous than outright exposure. Avoiding risk is no less dangerous than outright exposure. Life is a grand adventure or nothing.
Nothing
Helen
at all.
Keller said that. Mm-hmm. Helen Keller said that. That's also been a guiding mantra in my life. And I, given everything, I measure it all against the worst thing that could ever have happened to me. And I know what that was. And my invitation to every other human being is to identify the worst moment in your life, that the worst thing that could have ever happened to you happened, and use that as your measuring stick against everything else. Because life is going to keep handing you buckets of shit. You just have to identify, oh, is this my shit? Or is this somebody else's shit? Am I going to carry their bucket of shit for them? I don't think so. I got my own, and I don't even want to carry that. So, you know, I mean, there are so many ways to come at this, and I'm so grateful for this conversation, because I can't believe it's been over an hour. You're going to have to come back for a part two, because this conversation, I want to hear all about your ayahuasca journey.
Oh, yeah. Let's do that when I come back. Yes.
Please do that. One thing that I've done, speaking of questions, in this fourth season, is that I like to wrap up by putting my co-host on the spot and sharing with you a question that the previous co-host asked. And almost 100% of the time, it was just the right question for it. It's all intuitive, right?
Mm-hmm.
As you're answering the question I'm about to ask you, be thinking of intuitively a question for the next co-host who don't know who they are. So this is engaging your imagination. It's getting the right and the left side of your brains at the same time. It's a beautiful thing. So you ready for your question?
I am.
Which is more important to follow, your passion or your purpose?
Oh, excellent.
Isn't that a great question? Who better?
That is deep. Yes, passion or purpose. To me, the first thing I would answer is, in my life, there really is no difference because my purpose is my passion and my passion is my purpose. I have always known that I'm here to make complicated processes, systems easy and help other people to be successful. And there's nothing that lights me up more. I still get up every day. I love it. And I know this is what I'm here to do. So to me personally, the two are so connected because how can you be in purpose if you don't have passion? And how can you have passion if you don't have purpose? I mean, I could have passion for chocolate, I suppose, but that would be shallow in the framing of this particular question. So the answer to me is, it's a trick question. And I don't see it as an either or, it is an and.
Shadow and Light LLC was established by Dave Roberts and Reverend Patty Farino, co-authors of When the Psychology Professor Met the Minister. Their mission is to empower individuals to transcend life's challenges by integrating spiritual practices with psychology to achieve peace. They are available for individualized spiritual counseling, virtual or in-person book club meetings, or presentations and workshops to universities, organizations, and other interested groups. For further information, visit psychologyprofessorandminister.com.
I'm with you 100%. And what's interesting about this is that the person who asked the question believed his answer was that his passion was more important, that the purpose changes throughout life, and the passion is the fire in your belly that makes you, you know, it's the fuel in your tank to manifest what you want to manifest. But your purpose is flimsy and it doesn't really, you know, comes and goes. I disagree with him. I agree with you. You know, my overarching purpose in my life is everything. It's solid. It's my expression in the world. It's where the deep joy in my soul meets a great need in the world. That's my purpose. Mm-hmm. That's my calling. Mm-hmm. So calls to me and from me. And for me, that's universal life skills, education, and mentoring and conversation. And under that umbrella is my philanthropic work. It is my theater work, my art, and it is my mentoring, counseling, life skills, this podcast, and so forth. They're all tied together. They couldn't exist without one another. I'm trying to figure out right now, how do I bring them all into one thing? Because I feel like a vaudevillian plate spinner. You know that feeling, right?
That is what I do. That is my super skill of especially working with visionaries, crazy big thinkers, colorful people, non-conforming people that do something unusual, and take all these people, these pieces, and assemble them into one cohesive thing so that there's a full transformation journey.
Yes.
So, you know, going back to sort of this intuitive and, you know, and wrapping this all up, but I think this is a great way to wrap it up, is to think about that, and maybe this ties in the passion or purpose piece, because even if the purpose adjusts itself, The pieces are more as you go. It would be preposterous for us to say God requires us to learn something and then forget it and not use it. The idea is for this bucket of beauty that we assemble in our lifetime to utilize that and make that the center of the message. So that it's like, oh yeah, there's a core. And here's the universe from which out it emanates in all these different directions. And I give you 5 different entry points into this transformational journey, because now it has a beginning and an end. And it is not a hotel room for one night. It is a life journey with different stops along the way on whether or not your train takes you where it's supposed to take you or not.
Exactly. Exactly. So what's your question for the next co-host?
My question would be around failure. I would say, what is the definition of a great mistake and a bad mistake?
Ooh, good one. Good one. Do you have an answer for yourself?
Well, to me, I have learned that mistakes are really an absolute illusion, that the perception of the mistake is the definition that I give it as a mistake. I have learned to think about it as me not updating my GPS, driving in my car, and inevitably they're building the freeway. It's a cul-de-sac now. Exactly. Am I going to get out of my car? Am I going to throw myself on the ground? Am I going to throw a temper tantrum? I'll never drive again. I'm such a lousy driver. Oh my God, I'm giving my car back. The DMV can they have the driver's license back. This is it. This is the worst day of my life. That's it. I'm going to end it all right here. I'm going to walk from here. We do no such thing. We just go like, should have updated the GPS.
Right.
Thank you for letting me know. Nice person with a stop sign.
Exactly. I just saw, I was doom scrolling. I love that term, doom scrolling. And there was this kid who was probably late teens, maybe early 20s. And he was so perplexed because he had been helping his mom clean out their garage or something. And he had found an old map, like the map that we used to keep in our glove box in the car. Right.
This oh, is yeah, 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 yeah.
Or a GPS. And he's like unfolding it. He said, this was your GPS. And it was this giant piece of paper. And he's like, how can you drive and read that? I can't even read this thing. And I know for a fact that that's not there anymore. And, you know, it's just, it was such a funny, this is what reminded me of this, you know, the tools that we have of our time. He said, all I've got to do is ask, you know, my GPS where the next turn is, right? And I still miss the turn. But you had
to, and then it'll give me another turn.
You had to pull out this thing and try and figure it out. That wasn't that long ago. Things are moving. They're moving fast. And that's why staying in the moment, being grateful, being open is vitally important for the now and for whatever future you imagine. Beata, this was awesome. And I am so excited to meet a new friend, operate on the same frequency. This is a joy for me. It's a great way to end my tough day. And so thank you for being here. Thank you for being so open, laying it all out on the table, letting us get to know who you are. And I hope we do stay in touch, because I'm really interested in where this ayahuasca journey takes you.
That makes two of us. Thank you so much for having me. And I want to just give you a shout out really quick. So if you enjoyed this interview, please, please, please do Henry a favor. Subscribe to the podcast and leave a comment. And comments are really critically important, because it changes the algorithm and it shows the engagement. And it just helps Henry to put this in podcast in front of more lost travelers. And share this episode with one other person that needs to hear what we were talking about today, and we'll be so grateful for it.
Thank you for that. Nobody's ever done that before. I feel like crying. You know, nobody leaves comments. Nobody leaves reviews. It's you know, but I also know how many listeners I have and how many countries that I'm reaching. So even though they're a silent audience, I know that it's reaching people. Somebody said recently that in the body of your podcast, ask your listeners to put a green heart in the comments section so that it's a sign that they listened to the whole thing. I thought that was really innovative and cool, because very often people just listen to the first couple minutes and then they tune out and go on to other things. But there's a lot of juicy stuff in here, and I hope people do.
There is. Well, the thing is that people say, like, 20-minute, 30-minute podcast because it's the duration of a workout. I'm like, that's all you work out? 20, 30 minutes? What's wrong with you people? Exactly. A good workout is at least an hour, if not 90 minutes.
What about those of us like me who are disabled and can't work out? Right? You got all the time in the world. You could go for, go for a walk, or you could be folding your laundry or that. And actually, this is why I keep it audio only, because we listen differently mm-hmm. when it's audio only. I mean, the visual is great, but it's also when we hear something, we listen. And we can multitask to do dishes. And
yeah, I like listening to this when I hike.
Yeah.
So that I'm in a different, because I'm kind of in a meditative, repetitive
right.
motion. And then I can listen to something. Interesting enough, when I go to the gym, I listen to crime shows. Now, whatever that means, yeah. I may have to go into it a different way. But if I'm outside, I listen to something different. Yeah.
Well, I got to run. Somebody's at my door. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Take care. I appreciate you.
You. Bye. For you too. Bye.
You've been listening to season 4 of the Lost Traveler podcast with Henry Cameron Allen. Visit me online at henryallen.org. Thank you to my guests, and thank you for tuning in. Let's keep striving for a better world together.